forms our understanding of who we are as male and female and how we think about marriage and sexuality. Now, the first question that I think is important to address is why listen to the Pope? I don't know how many of you here are good Protestants, and maybe some of you have differing views on exactly how much you should or should not listen to Roman Catholics. I grew up in the context of my church we kind of assumed that Catholics weren't really Christians. And different people have different perspectives on that. Now, I do want to be clear, there are some deep differences between Catholics and Protestants, so I don't want to belittle those differences. But at the same time, I think there's also a danger of belittling or ignoring similarities. And so I think that it is actually important to engage this. It doesn't mean that we're going to agree maybe with everything that John Paul II says, but I do think it's a very helpful place to begin. I think part of this is that to be Reformed is to be Catholic with a little c. And maybe you're not Reformed, and that's fine, but to be a good whatever, Baptist or Pentecostal. I think to be a good Christian is to be Catholic, little c, is to recognize that we are united in Christ and that there is a sense of importance about actually being connected to other Christians. And so this is why even when we recite the Apostles' Creed at my church, we do say the Holy Catholic Church. This makes some people nervous because they think you're talking about this means we're Roman Catholic. No, the idea here, though, is that we're affirming the core truths of what the church has always affirmed. And so we recognize that the denomination I belong to didn't arise until the 1600s. Well, I don't think the Holy Spirit took a break between the time of Jesus and 1600. There are good things, there are bad things there, but I think we have to embrace a good sense of Catholicity and connection. I also think one of the things that I very much appreciate about Catholic thinking on this is that it is clear, it's coherent, it's consistent, it's deep, and it is explicit. By that, I don't mean that it gives explicit details about human sexuality, but I mean that you can actually go to the Catholic Catechism and you will find them addressing all kinds of different issues. And I think this has to do especially with, not just with issues of human sexuality, but just social ethics in general. So, for example, the Roman Catholic Church has several documents, authoritative documents, that talk about issues like euthanasia. How should Christians think about euthanasia? This is very much, I think, more of a moral or ethical issue that's certainly tied to our theological perspective. But if you were to say, you know, if I want to know what the CRC thinks about this or the RCA or other Protestant bodies, where do you go to find that? Well, the CRC does have a little website with kind of issues that they address, but usually it's a couple paragraphs. And so what I think that Protestants, many Protestants are finding is that the Roman Catholic Church actually serves as a very valuable source of social ethics, that they have thought through these things from basic Christian principles in ways that most Protestants would indeed agree with. And so I hear a number of different professors from different institutions looking to Roman Catholic social teaching on a lot of things because they've actually developed this. It's explicit, and you can find them talking about it at length. I think that's important. That's part of what I grew up in a congregational Baptist church, where it was kind of like, well, what do we believe? Well, whatever the pastor kind of says right now. It wasn't really quite that extreme, but there were some churches where it could be, where essentially it was what the pastor says goes, and that's about it. And so I was drawn to the broader Christian tradition. I was drawn to academic theology because I appreciated the fact that there was something deeper there, that there was a sense of consistency, that there was the desire to be coherent in how we think about this. So I think that's something helpful that we see here. A third thing is, I think, the commitment to a new evangelization. And this is a term that John Paul II used to try to reinvigorate the church, to try to preach the good news about who Jesus is and the good news about our bodies and human sexuality to people within the church and beyond. Now, here's an interesting question. If you were to
I'm actually looking for some feedback here, okay? But think about this. If you were to rate on a scale of 1 being worst and 10 being best, what would you say the average churchgoer, what is their level of comfort with talking about and communicating clearly to youth and to others about human sexuality and male and female?
7.
Fairly comfortable. Disagree? High? Is that high?
I think it's high.
2.
Okay. 4.
I think it's really high.
2. 5.
3.
Okay. So maybe some of this depends on your own experience a little bit. I'm not going to ask. Maybe I should make a. I'm going to make a poll on Sakai, so that it's anonymous. But even to ask questions like, I mean, what's your parents' level of comfort in time, right? Everyone's like, no, what's my level of comfort with my parents? No, right? That's right. It's not their problem. It's my problem. Stop talking to me about this. Right? The stork brought me. Thank you, Mom and Dad. That's all we want. But I think part of what we have to do, I think, is to find not only better language, but better ways of talking about who we are as male and female and what that means. And so it really is a matter of looking at our context, being aware of our context in our culture and saying, what do we as Christians need to do to help people understand who we are? Because it really is an increasingly strange thing to be a Christian and to affirm these things. So I think it's good, I think it's helpful to listen to the Pope. I am not advocating that you agree with everything that he says here, but I think it gives us a starting point. Because he is, you know, this is another thing I like about the Catholic Church, the Pope is actually a theologian. He's not just like, I'm an executive director who kind of administrates things. He's a theologian, and I think probably one of the theologians who thought most about this. Just to be clear, we are talking about Pope John Paul II, not Pope Francis. So everybody, I just want to make sure we're all tracking with that. So today we want to think about, first of all, our origin and destiny. What do we learn about who we are? In terms of our origin, oftentimes people will speak about creation as creation ex nihilo. Probably heard this term in doctrine, creation out of nothing. In other words, the point is that God doesn't take some kind of pre-existing matter and mold it. God actually brings everything into existence. But I think it's equally accurate and maybe actually more helpful to speak about creation ex amore. Any fans of Latin who can
remember
this? Love. Right, exactly. That when we think about our creation, it is accurate to say we're created out of nothing, but it's also accurate to say we are created out of love. So at the origin of all creation, including us, is this sense of being drawn out of nothingness into existence out of God's love for us. And that's what draws us, at the very ground of our being is this fact that we are created from God's love and we are created for love. That's significant. It goes to the heart of who we are. When we do think about creation, I think it's important to understand it and be clear that there's a reason Christians go back to Genesis. In part because this is even the pattern that we see in Jesus. In Matthew 19, if you have your Bibles, when Jesus thinks about what it means to be created male and female, when he thinks about marriage, his pattern is to go back to creation. And so in Matthew 19:3, the Pharisees come to test Jesus and they ask him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? Haven't you read, he replied, that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, for this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. This is significant. He goes on to talk about the law, but I think it's significant to see he doesn't just go to the Mosaic law to say, let me help you understand what marriage is all about. Rather, he goes all the way back to the beginning.
there is something then that is normative about what we see in creation. I remember having this discussion a few years ago with folks from my church as we were looking at different passages about men and women and about the issue of women in church office and leadership. And somebody asked, you know, well, why does everybody keep talking about Genesis 1 and 2? Why do people keep going there? And it occurred to me, not everybody recognizes this basic hermeneutical principle, that there is something very significant about being rooted in creation. We're talking about being connected to God's original intention for humanity, an intention that gets distorted by sin. So that even in the Mosaic Law, Jesus says, you know, Moses, that these things are there because of the hardness of your heart. That even in the law, what you see is God working with a less than ideal situation. Not saying divorce is good, divorce is part of God's original intention, but rather, given sinful humanity and the reality of divorce, here's how you should manage that situation. But even the way you manage that is not the same as being connected to God's original intention. And so when we look at the beginning, when we go back to Genesis 1 and 2, you see that male and female serve as the creational icon of new creation. So I think here is a great place to see how you get the link between creation and new creation. That it's important, the twofold importance first is to recognize that who we are as male and female has significance in and of itself. Okay, so this is something good, something that we go back to, something that we focus on. But Ephesians 5 says, male and female, husband and wife are so important precisely because you need that to be functioning in the way it should, so that it can point to Christ and the church. Right? And so in that sense, having husband and wife, male and female, being functional, that's good, that's helpful, that's part of God's original intentions. But it also has to be functioning that way for it to serve as a pointer in the way that it should. And so when we think about something like divorce, this is precisely the problem, is that it introduces this element of unfaithfulness into this icon. And when you're ministering to kids who have suffered parents' divorce, I think that does something to their ability to trust other people. It does something to their ability even to trust God, that God is going to be faithful to what he says. And so you need this properly functioning marriage relationship to serve as a sign and pointer. And I think this is why you see all throughout the prophets, right, this relationship between God and his people is seen as this marriage covenant, a covenant that his people continually break. And because they continually break it, they sacrifice their ability to be a sign and pointer to the one true God. And so I think we have to hold these things together, this twofold importance. This is good in and of itself, marriage, male and female, but it's also good because it points to something beyond itself. So we hold these together. So love is our origin. Love is also our destiny. Quoting the Catholic Catechism, the book says this: God has revealed his innermost secret. God himself is an eternal exchange of love, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and he's destined us to share in that exchange. That this is how the entire goal of who we are is understood. God is love. You have this eternal love of the triune persons for one another. And in creating us, God's intention is to draw us into that life and love. Now let me just ask, have you heard it talked about this way before? Does this fit with how you might think about your own, you know, what's the end goal of the Christian life? To share in this eternal communion of love. Is that something that, I'm actually curious, or is that kind of a new thing? Yeah.
Like, I always knew in the love in the sense that, you know, church in Christ, but I never ever thought about thinking, you know, Trinitarian way.
Okay.
Yeah.
You have this communion of persons, and that our human communion is meant to be a sign and pointer of that, but it's meant to draw us further into this. Now, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but here's how I think about this. Because for a lot of Protestants, I think we're shaped by the Reformation. And what was the key, you know, what was the key cry of the Reformation? Faith. Justification by faith. That it's not by works, but it's by trust in the grace of God, trust in Christ's work alone. And so I think for a lot of Protestants, kind of the primary thing that we think about when it comes to our relationship with God is belief. Do you have faith? Do you believe God? Do you trust in God? I don't know about you, but what, you know, when I think about the kind of sermons that I heard as a kid growing up, and many sermons that I still hear, what's the end goal? The end goal is to help you believe, maybe for the first time, or maybe to believe stronger or to strengthen your belief. I think this is a little bit different from saying that the end goal here is love. The end goal is not just to believe in God, but the end goal is to love God as you should and love your neighbor as yourself. Does that sound familiar? Hopefully it sounds familiar to everybody. So it's there, it's in the Bible, but I think we sometimes miss this. And so, you know, when you look at 1 Corinthians 13, clearly faith, hope, and love, these are important, but the greatest of these is love. Why? Because faith becomes sight, because hope is fulfilled, but love remains, love endures. Love is eternal in that way, that faith and hope are not. And so it may be a shift in thinking, but the end goal here is not just to believe in God and to draw others to believe in God. The end goal is to love God as we should and to draw others into that love as well. And so that, I think, is a helpful way to understand our destiny. It also makes, I think, we then start to see how human relationships fit into and are connected with this in a deeper way. That we are made from love. We're wired, so to speak, for love. Our destiny is love. And so it's no wonder that, you know, when we think about our lives, we are caught up in all kinds of relationships, some that are loving well, some that are loving not so well. But we're wired for that because we bear the image of this Trinitarian God. Now, I want to make a few exegetical notes on Genesis 1 and 2. So let's, if you have your Bibles, you can go back there. I have several of the significant texts up here. But a few things I want you to see. The first is simply to realize that the Hebrew word Adam can be translated some different ways. It can be translated as a man or the man. It can be translated mankind. Or sometimes it gets translated, as in the case of Genesis 1 and 2. It's not even translated, it's just transliterated. Right? So this is kind of interesting. Like, should this be seen as Adam's name, or is this just saying, well, this is what the Hebrew word sounds like, we're just going to translate that direct or transliterate that into English? Maybe not always the best. But you see this in a couple of places. In Genesis 1, God says, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea, birds, livestock, animals, other things. Significant here, I think, it's important to recognize that mankind here includes male and female. And so when we talk about what it means to be an image bearer of God, now some of you might just be thinking, well, yeah, obviously male and female are both created in the image of God. Unfortunately, some throughout church history have not been so clear about that and see being a male as sort of a more perfect image bearer and female being a more deficient version of that. And so I just want to be clear, I think in the text itself, you get this in the next verse as well. God created Adam, mankind, in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them.
And so Genesis 1, right, which gives you the big sweep of things, and then Genesis 2, we're going to get more narrowly focused. But Genesis 1 is very clear. Humanity is created in the image of God. Yeah?
My translation says, so I think this is the ESV. God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them.
Yeah.
So it depends.
It's man, mankind, humanity. These are all ways to say the generic way of talking about humanity. Yeah. And so what makes it a little bit more difficult is... Yeah, a lot of people do, I think, still use man in a generic sense. Some people don't, though, and I think increasingly in our culture, when you just use the term man, people don't take that to mean any human being. They take it to mean a specifically sexed, gendered human being. And so this is where translation, a good translation, has to be aware of how language is used in its audience. And not be, side note, translations, I think, should not be ideologically driven, as though we need to make sure this says man or male. Right? We need to be careful of that. But yeah, this word will be translated different ways in other translations. And so in Genesis 2, you find this word appearing again. In verse 7, "And the Lord God formed Ha-Adam from the dust of the ground, breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and Ha-Adam became a living being." No, the Adam, the human. "It is not good for Ha-Adam to be alone. I will make a helper suitable for him." Now, again, this is a matter where people will go back and forth. Should this be translated, or should this be taken in a more generic sense, or in a more specific sense? Is this, at this point, is the text talking about a male, or is this just a way of talking about the human that was there, and thus far you don't have a kind of differentiation yet? So this is, you still have this language of Ha-Adam being used. I do want to note, if my hyperlink will work here, the term helper that's used in this text. I don't know about what you think of when you hear the English word helper. Maybe you think of like Santa's little helper, or like, you know, junior assistant. And so sometimes this can be a little bit confusing. Again, when we think about who we are as male and female, is the woman created in this context to be a kind of junior assistant or a kind of lesser helper? When you look at how this word, this Hebrew word, is used elsewhere. You actually see it being used in Genesis, but you see it also used in a variety of ways, especially in Psalms, in a way that uses this term to refer to God. God as the help. God as the helper. So this word is not something that just by itself shows us that this is meant to indicate some sense of inferiority. In fact, in the case of God, it clearly assumes that someone who is more powerful, who is more capable... who provides the help. And so I don't want you to get hung up on that as a potential source of confusion. All right, Bible Hub. We'll come back to Bible Hub in a minute. Yes?
This is something really interesting because my dad and I were just talking about this a couple days ago, about how when it talks about helper in Genesis, a lot of people view that as something lesser, like, oh, here's a helper for you because it's not good for you to be alone. But, and then going on to talk about how when it talks about helper later on in the Bible, what it's talking about is reference to God. And so it's just interesting that we talked about that today.
Yeah.
I was just talking to my dad about that.
Yeah. And yeah, that's interesting. Just coming out of that conversation.
Yeah.
I actually recently had a conversation with my mother-in-law about it. And she kind of made the point that it's the difference between, like, is it my grandson helping me in the kitchen, saying, "Hey, can you please hand me that spoon?" Or is it I'm on the side of the road, my tire's flat, and I can't change it. I need to call someone to change this for me.
Yeah.
It's something that I can't do.
Yeah.
So it's the two different kinds of help, and the one being the one who can do what I cannot do.
Yeah. 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 I think that's an important distinction here, because as the text unfolds, you know, maybe one way to say this is that the helper, quote unquote, the helper is actually essential to what has to be done. It's not kind of like, well, if I have a helper, that'd be nice, but if I don't, I guess I can do it anyway. The point is, this helper is absolutely essential. And maybe from a practical standpoint, I can only reflect on my experience as a college male and what my wife did in terms of helping me. And I think, yeah, dude needs some help. And right when I look at my life and how I function, it is very clear that my wife is not just like, oh yeah, it's not, she can help me out with some stuff. It's like we are one person. You can't pull us apart without our lives both falling apart. And so you have to have that there. So in as Genesis 2 unfolds, you get this, wait for it, splitting the atom. Yeah. All right. Yes. I couldn't tell if those were groans of amazement or but I'm just gonna take it as amazement. That's really insightful. By the way, like right now at home especially, I'm loving having kids the age they are because they think like everything their dad does is awesome. So I'm relishing this because I know it's gonna quickly fade. Like their favorite thing, like at the end of dinner time, I'll come in like, oh, we're gonna have some oranges for dessert. I'll come in juggling two oranges and they're like, yeah, woo! Like we've never seen such a thing.
Yeah,
it's a real ego booster to have people who are just like, it kind of doesn't matter what you do, they think it's awesome, or like whatever joke I can come up with on the spot, because this is like, my kids will tell jokes at dinner times, but they're kind of, I haven't figured out if my kids just don't get how jokes are supposed to work, or if they have like this absurdist postmodern nihilistic sense of humor. I'm like, that's not, wait. Is that funny? Anyway, so but I can make them knock jokes on the spot, and they're like, "What? That's so amazing!" So I'm enjoying this. So in Genesis 2, splitting the atom, a couple of exegetical notes I think are important to get what's happening in this passage. Here's how I think we often read Genesis 2 from a modern perspective. We read about Adam going into a deep sleep, God taking this rib from Adam's side. And so we filter it through our lens, and we read this as a kind of surgery. Right? God gives him his anesthesia, so he falls asleep, so he's out, he doesn't feel this. And then God kind of does this physical procedure to produce the woman. When in fact, the phrase here that gets translated deep sleep, this is used elsewhere in Genesis. It's used in Genesis 15 when Abraham has this vision of God coming as God makes this covenant with him. And the idea behind this is not that Adam or that Abraham is just asleep or unconscious, but rather this is almost a vision of sorts that is meant to reveal something that's deeply theological. And so rather than perceiving Adam as just being kind of out of it on the operating table, what you see is Adam is coming to understand this deep truth about who humanity is as male and female. And so the point of all this is not just to tell us about the material process, but to shape our theological insight into reality. This is significant because, again, I think a lot of times in Genesis 1 and 2, modern scientific people get so focused on kind of the material aspects of this that we miss the theological point of the text, which is not about God performing physical surgery. The other thing that's interesting here is that, I don't know, does your Bible say in verse 21 that while Adam was sleeping, he took one of the man's ribs? Does everybody's Bible say ribs? Anybody else say anything else?
Everybody's got ribs.
Footnote.
I want my baby back, baby. Footnote? What's a footnote say?
It says, or took a part of the man's side.
Okay, took a part of the man's side. Fun note on the Hebrew again. If you look at this word, which appears about 41 times in the Old Testament, Genesis 2 is the only place that it gets translated as rib. Because this term, as we look at it, is actually more of an architectural term. Architecture. I don't know if I've ever had to spell that on the whiteboard before. Okay, I think that's right. It is an architectural term, not really an anatomical term. And so, when we look at how this is used elsewhere, the primary place where this is talked about is in Exodus 25, when it talks about the construction of the tabernacle. See, you find it multiple times in Exodus. You get it in 1 Kings, where it's talking about the construction of the temple, and Ezekiel 41, where you get this vision of the new temple. Now, here's what I think is interesting. Well, for one thing, again, I think this helps us see that the point here is not just to give a physical description of the surgery, but rather that this could probably be better translated that she is taken out of his side. Right? With the idea here that you have Adam, in some sense, kind of split in half, and now you have the two halves, the man and the woman, who are functioning in this way. I also think that this might be, I haven't pursued this, I need to pursue this more, but I have a hunch. Professor's intuition. I need to track down, see if I can confirm this. But in 1 Corinthians 6, okay, Paul talks about our bodies as the temple of God, and he is specifically criticizing some of the Corinthian men who are still sleeping with prostitutes, and he goes back to Genesis 2, he references this text, when he talks about our bodies as the temples of God. Now, my intuition is this. I think he knows that this word is used primarily in the context of tabernacle and temple. And that in Genesis 2, then, I think there's perhaps a connection to how he thinks about our bodies as the temple of God and what happens in sexual union as being this important thing. It's not something that's just frivolous or should be treated lightly. But that male and female are meant to image God, and that we see that in the way that this is set up in the beginning. And so you have then, after this discussion, after the Adam is split, the statement that she shall be called woman, Isha, because she was taken out of man, Ish. Again, different word here than Adam. And I think, again, part of what we see, even in the language here, is that they're closely linked. It's not as though male and female are, you know, the men are from Mars and women are from Venus or whatever. You know, that we're no. You know, somebody should write a book called Men Are From Earth, Women Are From Earth. Right? That's kind of the point. And actually, you know, the dust of the ground, they're connected to the earth. They have this sense of, you know, this is their home. And there's also a sense of they are more like each other than anything else. Right? There's no suitable helper anywhere else. And so sometimes we tend to emphasize how different male and female are. And I think Genesis 2 actually shows how close they are, how similar they are to one another. And so the outcome of this text is a practical application. And again, sometimes I think we miss this. But what is this whole text meant to do? It's meant to explain why a man leaves his father and mother, is united to his wife, and they become one flesh, right? They form this new unit in and of themselves. And so the point of all this is not just to give us this background information, but to say this is why a man leaves his family and establishes this new unit, this new marriage, this new life with his wife. So there's that kind of practical outcome. I do want to mention briefly, we'll come back to this a little bit later in class, but what you see going on in Genesis 1 and 2, I think also makes us aware that this is not just about male and female, man and wife, but that there is embedded in the creation mandate of Genesis 1:28, this procreation mandate. The first thing God says to them in Genesis 1:28 is be fruitful and increase in number. And so this point, the point is not just that Adam and Eve have each other, but the point is that this union results in this production, procreation of more human beings, more image bearers. And so when we read in Genesis 2:18, it's not good for the man to be alone. I think this is actually very closely connected to the creation mandate. This is not God saying like, well, you know, if he doesn't have a spouse, he's going to spend all his Friday evenings at the movies alone. That's kind of a downer, right? He's going to sit around and, you know, write bad poetry because he's all alone. And as long as, whatever happens. So the idea isn't just like this sense of existential loneliness. The language of not good here is connected to humanity being able to fulfill their function. And their function is be fruitful and multiply. How easy is that to do by yourself? Not going to happen. Right? Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, rule over the earth, subdue these things. You have to have people and more people to do this. And so again, this is the only time when you hear God saying it's not good. Right? It's not good. It's not functional. This thing can't operate the way I intended it to do because of this. And so we need to again see that it takes both of them, male and female, together to actually fulfill the creation mandate and the procreation mandate. Let me stop there for a minute before moving on. Questions or comments about some of these exegetical notes or other things we've looked at thus far? All right. Yes?
When it comes to procreation, so since Christ gave us a new covenant, you know, and now we are living in a new covenant, are we... Okay, let me put this... So, are we still under the commandment of procreation?
Yeah.
Because I think that really brings the light into homosexual debate as well.
Yeah.
Because if we are supposed to follow the God's commandment, especially in procreation wise, I think homosexual relationship cannot be tolerated because. Like you say, not good means they cannot function properly. Obviously, in homosexual relationship, procreation is not possible. And I guess it's safe for us to say it's not good for us to be, for anyone to be in homosexual relationship. But if we are no longer under this commandment of, procreation, fruitful and multiply, I think we can possibly argue that, why not homosexuality, as long as there's love between partners.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So this is, we'll answer this in much greater detail as the course goes along. But you're exactly right to say how we're going to handle this is significant. And I think it's significant not just for thinking about same-sex relationships, but even thinking about the place of children within marriage. So we live in a culture that has largely, again, kind of set procreation aside as not really having a place of significance. And so how do we understand that properly? And so my answer or my comment is yes, more to come on this as we go. But it is interesting to me that I've been around, the way that especially Reformed folks talk about the creation mandate. We're called to make culture, we're called to do these things. That's right here. But are sometimes less than attentive toward the procreation mandate or kind of don't have thought through how those things work together. And so it's a significant topic and it's a significant one or the significant one that we'll unpack further as we go along. Just want to say a couple things about Christology before we look at anthropology. I found it interesting. Again, this goes back to our discussion on the first day of class. But in many ways, I think... Part of what theology of the body puts forth is the idea that if we really want to know who we're supposed to be as male and female, we actually should look more at the second Adam than the first Adam. That we should look more at Jesus, which again seems counterintuitive. I should look to a celibate man to understand what the meaning of marriage really is. But I think that's right. I think that's what we see in the New Testament, and I think the more that we reflect on it theologically, the more that we understand this. One of the key themes of this is that a proper understanding of ourselves, a proper understanding of sexuality, involves self-giving versus grasping and possessing. And so I think here, especially about Philippians 2 and the way Philippians 2 talks about Jesus, that even though he was fully God, he didn't hang on to those things. But he gave himself fully and freely to us, and in doing so, right, truly fulfilled his purpose. Hebrews 12 talks about for the joy set before him. Right? So this is an enormous sacrifice, but it's who he is. That Jesus, if we can say it this way, Jesus finds himself in fully giving himself. And I think the same thing goes for us, that we try to find ourselves by grasping and possessing certain things, by defining ourselves in certain ways, when in fact the way that we truly understand who we are and figure out who we're supposed to be is when we give ourselves away. And so Christopher West in the book talks about this link between communion of persons that happens in human sexuality and the Lord's Supper, saying that what do we celebrate in the Lord's Supper? We celebrate, you know, this is my body, right? That's given to you and for you. There is a sense in which every time we celebrate the Lord's Supper or communion, this is a foretaste of the marriage supper of the Lamb that we read about in Revelation. And so there is this real sense of giving and receiving that happens there, that is a picture or that is Christ giving himself fully to us, that then calls us to understand ourselves in light of this giving. And so this is what John Paul II calls the spousal meaning of the body. We'll come back to this term, so very important that you get this. The spousal meaning of the body. The body's power to express love, precisely that love in which the human person becomes a gift. Right? And so here, I think, big picture theologically, we understand, or we should understand, our own being is a gift. Right? That we are drawn out of nothingness completely because of God's grace. Not because of anything that we did to establish this or that God kind of had to do this or was compelled to do this. Our very being is a gift. And so when we recognize that, we then in turn are able to give ourselves fully to others. So the human person becomes a gift and through this gift fulfills the very meaning of his being and existence. Now, one thing that's important, hopefully you caught this, John Paul II wants to be very clear, this is not just for married people. Okay, that sexuality and the when we think about sexual union within marriage, this is a picture of that. But even, and maybe even especially single people, can do this as well. Now, it doesn't mean that you would do it in the same way sexually, but it means that you learn something about who we are. Your very being is a gift, and you are called to give yourself for the sake of God's kingdom. So I want to be clear that when we talk about the spousal meaning of the body, this is not a meaning of the body that is just for spouses. This is a meaning of the body for everybody. All right, pressing on. When we think about anthropology then, so I think we have to get this right. We have to properly understand who we are as human beings, what it means to be created as creatures who are body and soul, if we want to really understand our sexuality. And this is going to get at what he means when he talks about our bodies as a sacrament. Very important to establish what's going on here. But I want to give you just a couple different positions here so that this is on your radar. Again, this is a matter of discussion in Doctrine 2, but I want to remind us of this. We can talk about a hard dualism where you've got a very, almost this divorce between the body and soul. Some people see humanity as made up of two very distinct things, an immaterial soul and a material body. And that those two are kind of in some way, shape, or form, it's almost like they're glued together, these two distinct things. And that at a certain point, maybe even at death, for a philosopher like Plato, death is a good thing because you lose the body and now you're just an immaterial soul. And it's way better to be an immaterial soul because why? Well, you don't get hungry. You're not subject to sexual desire or lust. Right? You can sit in class all day and you never get tired or bored because you're just pure mind. Right? Isn't this great? Right? So our bodies are dragging us down. So there's this negative view. Or in modern philosophy, somebody like Descartes thinks about who we are as human beings as primarily mind. What is a human being? A human being is a thinking thing. And so for Descartes, it almost becomes a problem to say, how is this mind linked to the body? Because they're seen as two very, very distinct things. And I would submit that I think hard dualism is actually not the biblical or the proper theological view. So it's out there, and even a lot of Christians, I think, have kind of bought into this view. But I think drawing this kind of hard line between body and soul is actually not helpful. On the other hand, a lot of people in our culture, I think, have a reductionistic view of who we are as human beings. And so one way to reduce who we are is to say, okay, you've got body and soul. One side of this would just say, we are purely material. That's all we are, matter in motion. We're living in a material world, and I'm a material girl. Right? So, that was a quote. So that it's purely material. So that the way that we understand ourselves and our bodies is even in a way that's reductionistic, that even probably a good psychologist or psychiatrist would say, yeah, that doesn't work. You're not just matter in motion. There's something else going on. On the other hand, there have been some people, probably less, but others would try to say, like, who we are as human beings is just purely spiritual, and reject kind of any notion of the body, see the body not just as, well, maybe it's necessary, but see the body as bad in and of itself. I think the proper view, then, is what I would call a holistic dualism, that body plus soul is a living person. And so when we think about who we are as human beings, we're not two things, body and soul kind of glued together, but we are one thing. Right? We're an embodied soul or spiritualized bodies, however you want to talk about it, that there is this very close, tight integration of body and soul. And so this is why I think in the biblical view of things, death is actually a bad thing. Unlike in Plato, death is a bad thing because you have this state of abnormality. Human beings were not meant to live as disembodied souls, you know, sitting on a cloud somewhere on a harp or you know, playing a harp, as though souls could sit or play harps. A little bit confusing. Well, we solved that problem. I plucked it with the strict hands of my mind. I'm not sure how that would work. And so this, I think, is very important for how we understand sexuality, because I think there can be a tendency, even in our sexuality, it's fitness for life, sprinting around the halls. They're really pushing it. This is important for how we understand our sexuality, because I think even Christians who might recognize and say, you know, if you stop them and say, what do you really believe? They would say, okay, I believe this. But then in our views of sexuality can sometimes tend towards something like this, or like this. Right? Maybe even last time, some of the authors that we looked at tended towards some of this when they tried to articulate their theology of masturbation. Even though I went back and looked at that again and said, like, this whole thing was set up as a, what's your theological framework for? And then, like, half the people didn't even mention any theological framework. It was just kind of, like, purely material. We are living in a material world. So if we have this correct view, I think if we have this understanding of who we are as body and soul together, there are a few things that result. From this. Yes.
I have a question. I was listening to a sermon by Rabbi Zacharias, and he like quoted somebody that said, "We aren't a body. We are a soul. We just have a body."
Yeah.
So which one would that fit into?
I think that would fit more into hard dualism, because I would say you are. I don't like to say you are a soul, but you have a body. I would rather say you are a body, or you are a embodied soul, or you are, you know. And so I think to say you have a body kind of sounds like the body is just kind of this, like the real me is not tied to my body in any way. And I think that's problematic, you know, from a biblical perspective, that just kind of sees the body as, certainly the body changes, you know, the body dies, the body is resurrected. But I think to say, you know, if you you are a soul, but you just have a body, I think you end up even downplaying key points like the resurrection, where you say, well, in some ways, why do you need a resurrection? My soul needs saved. Who cares about my body? It's you know, it's kind of like whatever car you're driving as a college student, where it's like at a certain point it's going to die, and then good riddance. It's done. It's over with. Right? It served its purpose, and that's kind of it. I don't know. What do others think? Agree? Disagree? You have a body. You are a body.
I think similar, just to what you were saying about the importance of incarnation and resurrection. And if the body was not important or a part of who we are as, you know, bearing God's image, then why did God create a material world at all?
Yeah.
And as far as creation being normative.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost as though creation is just kind of a ladder that once we climb up, we kind of kick it out through, from under us and don't have it anymore. Yeah, there's even the interesting question. This is one of my favorite, in one of my favorite novels, Graham Greene's The End of the Affair. One of the characters poses this question: could you truly love God if God didn't have a body? Apart from the incarnation, right? Saying that there's something about the body of Jesus that allows us to truly, in some ways, understand God, relate to God in a way, love God even, in a way that you couldn't if God did not have a body. Because of who we are as embodied creatures, like, it's really hard for me to love an abstract idea or hate an abstract idea. Bodies are important. You need bodies. Even Voldemort knows that. You need bodies. Right? You have to have it. By the way, this is just a side note, but if you want to go into some of the theology going on in the intertestamental period and their understanding of who or what demons some of these demons were, in some of the books out there, Enoch and others, you have this flood, and part of the flood is to destroy these, like, angelic human hybrids that some people speculate is what's going on in Genesis 6. The reason they speculate that is because there's a lot of stuff that actually talks about that in the intertestamental period. So these divine human hybrids, the flood comes and destroys their bodies, and so now all they have left is this kind of, like, quasi angelic spark that is going around looking for a body, because to do something, it really helps to have a body in the material world. And so this is part of why you have these demons and other things, like, roaming around looking for bodies that they can then inhabit and overtake. Anyway, so it's kind of interesting to see some of this Jewish theology in the intertestamental period, which reminds me of Voldemort every time I read it. Like, oh, okay. All right, so Voldemort. Other questions or comments on this before we think about some of the implications here? All right. One result. I think what this does is it connects body and person. Divorcing body from person in sex or sexuality often leads to divorcing body and soul in myself. Okay, did you catch that? Divorcing body from person in sex or sexuality often leads to divorcing body, soul in myself. So here's where we come back to this notion of what is a sacrament? And again, for some of your traditions in the Reformed tradition, the Roman Catholic tradition does use this language of sacrament, although Reformed and Catholic folks differ on what exactly the sacraments are and exactly how they work. But other traditions don't use this language as much. But the idea behind a sacrament, this is explained, I think, a bit more in the West, is that a sacrament makes visible something that is invisible. It makes visible something that is invisible. And so it is a sign of something. So in the way that, you know, when we think about something like baptism, the water is significant, but the water also points to something deeper. Right? It's not just the water alone that would save somebody. This is part of our theology of why you can't just, you know, hook up a fire hose to your church's kitchen faucet and just go out on the street and start spraying people, because the water alone, right, is not what saves people. But here's the other angle on this, though. You actually do need water to have a baptism. And so the water alone is not sufficient. But it is necessary if you're going to baptize somebody. Yeah.
This is just something I thought of. What if, for instance, you're in a desert town and you're having a drought and there's like no water anywhere?
Yeah.
Somehow you're stuck in the town or whatever the case may be. Is there a different way that baptism can still happen? Like, say someone's dying, they want to be baptized.
Yeah. Sprinkling. No, not immersion. gather condensation off of whatever you've been baptized. But you know, that's actually a very good question that different churches have had to deal with precisely because of, in part, situations like that where water is either scarce or not easily accessible.
My church that I used to go to, my pastor one time was doing like a bedside at the hospital for a person who was very near death and wanted to be baptized, and obviously they couldn't do that there. I mean, we did immersion baptism. But he took the blanket and put it over him and then back away to kind of symbolize that, with that water.
Yeah, yeah. And so this is where, in general, the rule is normally, right? If you're in desperate, right? Normally, you have to have water. But even for the early church, they were faced with this because of certain martyrs, some of whom, you know, became martyrs like almost instantly after their conversion. Like they saw other martyrs being persecuted. They said, "I believe that. I want to follow Jesus." Well, what counts? You know, are they not saved? Are they not baptized? How do you think about this? So there are exceptions to the rule. This is why there's actually, you may or may not know this, but I think it was in the 13th century, I was reading about this last semester, the church actually ruled that you could not be baptized in beer. Good to have that on the books. Good to have that on the books. So disappointing. We'll actually come back to this throughout the semester, but what does this mean? Well, part of the point here is that the elements are actually significant, right? That the signs are actually significant. That you can't just say, "Well, I'm a big fan of Coke, so I'm going to love to be baptized in a syrupy." Not cocaine. High on Jesus. This is significant. Now, what's the point here then when we think about human bodies? Well, what does the body do? The body makes the person visible. Because think about this, when I talk about what makes a person, it's more than just their material components. It certainly includes their bodies, but it's more than that. Part of what makes you a person is even something like just your whole history. And so usually when you're getting to know somebody, you share certain things about your past, you share certain things about your likes or dislikes. These are not material things, but they are components of what make you a person. And part of how we know each other as persons is in and through our bodies. Right? The body makes the person visible. Does this make sense? Because this is like a really important point for West and for this to unfold. And maybe you've never thought about this before, this distinction between a body and a person. Now, certainly we would say, I think a person is more than their body. This is why, especially, you know, when we think about things like body image or something like that, part of the point that we might make is you are not just reducible to your body, that there's something more there. But this highlights that there is this necessary component of our bodies and that there is this fundamental link between bodies and person. And so this is why I can't just treat somebody else's body as though it's divorced from their personhood. What goes on in our bodies affects who we are as people. And you see this in, I think one example of this is in 1 Corinthians. We'll look there. I alluded to this text earlier, but if you have your Bibles, look at what Paul says here. again, you know, part of the reason that after I read this book by Harper, I've always read 1 Corinthians 6 before and thought, man, the church at Corinth is screwed up. Like, there are people who are Christians, and these guys are still going to prostitutes. And then all of a sudden you learn history, and you realize that was just considered normal for a respectable man of that day. It was moderation, not abstention. And then it's like, oh, okay. So he's kind of going through, like, 101, you know, biblical sexuality 101. So in 1 Corinthians 6, this is what he says. Starting in verse 12, he actually starts by quoting them. I have the right to do anything, you say, but not everything is beneficial. I have the right to do anything, but I will not be mastered by anything. You say, food for the stomach and the stomach for food, and God will destroy them both. The body, however, is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. By his power, God raised the Lord from the dead, and he will raise us also. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ himself? Shall I then take the members of Christ and unite them with a prostitute? Never. Do you not know that he who unites himself with a prostitute is one with her in body? For it is said, the two will become one flesh, but whoever is united with the Lord is one with him in spirit. Flee from sexual immorality. All the other sins a person commits are outside the body, but whoever sins sexually sins against their own body. And do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you've received from God? You are not your own. You were bought at a price. Therefore, honor God with your bodies. Now, I think as he engages the church at Corinth, what they're actually doing is they actually have this kind of hard dualism that says, you know, whatever. Eat whatever you want. The body's going to be destroyed. Do whatever you want sexually. The body's going to be destroyed. There's this kind of hard and fast line between body and soul. And Paul's saying, not so fast. That these things are tied together. That when you treat another person as disposable, as just something to be used, that is harming not only them, but you're also positing this improper body-soul distinction in yourself. Like, yeah, I do this with my body, but that's not really what I mean. That's not really who I am, right? Who I am spiritually, internally, is different from what I'm doing with my body. This is why, again, part of my critique of some of the authors we looked at last time was almost this same kind of thing that would say, I'm just doing this thing with my body. What's going on internally is really disconnected from this thing that's going on in my body. I don't think you can do that. That's not how we're made, I think, 1 Corinthians is saying.
Yeah. So if we have, you know, the connection between the body and the person, the soul, right? How you are your body and you don't just have a body, right? How do you address issues like transgender people? Right?
Yes.
Where they say, like, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body, right?
Yeah.
And they have that disconnect between their body and their soul.
Yeah, yeah. Good question. We'll get to that later in the semester. But it is a significant question because, yeah, how do we deal with that sense of dissonance? You know, this doesn't match. I feel internally, I feel one way. Externally, my body is something different. But it is it's difficult to navigate that. But we'll address that. See, all these things are like, they're all interrelated. You start seeing how this all is important. Another result here, I think a holistic anthropology allows for a holistic view of sexual union, sexual intercourse. So that when we think about, by the way, this is, you know, maybe you don't, we probably, because we only use the word intercourse in my experience, largely when you're talking about sexual union in our context. We don't realize that, you know, when you trace the etymology here, intercourse used to be kind of synonymous for communion, fellowship, etc. But most churches are not going to rename their fellowship halls today at risk of great confusion of people there. But I think the point then of thinking about sexual intercourse, sexual union, sexual fellowship, right, is to emphasize that it's more than just bodily. That this is certainly a bodily union, but it is meant to be a union of two persons, a union of two lives. And so this is, again, we come back to this idea of the sacrament making visible the invisible, that our understanding of sexual union should be should properly be understood, this union of two persons. It is not meant to be a purely physical act. And that's why I think, you know, when we recognize this, we start to see the point of view, the logic, I think, the Christian logic that says, you are saying something. Like, there is a language, there's something being communicated in and through our bodies. And the point is that you don't say this to just anybody. That's, I think, also the basis of Paul's criticism in 1 Corinthians 6. Notice, you know, he doesn't say, okay, when you have sex with a prostitute, the two really do not become one flesh. No, he says this act is saying something. It's this marital act. It's this act of union. But you're using it in the wrong way. You're saying it in the wrong way. I think understanding both of these things together as well can also help us think about what goes on, particularly in sexual abuse. Because when people suffer sexual abuse, I think one of the things that you see is, in order to cope, I think, in order to survive, you have to, in some sense, disconnect who you are from what's happening in your body. Right? And so that's a survival mechanism that kicks in. But then that also can make it hard going forward, you know, down the road, if you are in the context of marriage, it does make it more difficult then to reconnect or reunite those things, because you've so, for the sake of survival, you've rightly had to kind of divorce what's going on in your body or to your body from who you are as a person. And saying, indeed, I think this is where Christians say, just because you were abused in your body, that does not define who you are as a person. Right, that again, that's where I think it's helpful to say, you have a body, you are a body, but you're not reducible to that body, to help see this. Now, I wanted to give an illustration, actually, of what I think is not a holistic anthropology. This is from Alan Patton's book, Too Late to Fail a Rope, and it's a fascinating book. It's set in the context of apartheid South Africa, and a part of the setup for this is there is a husband who is kind of increasingly tempted to commit adultery, and kind of his own ability to navigate this relationship with his wife. And I think, let's just read this description. This is from the perspective of the husband. He said, "I wanted to cry out at her that I could not put the body apart from the soul, and that the comfort of her body was more than a thing of the flesh, but was also a comfort of the soul. And why it was, I could not say, and why it should be, I could not say, but there was in it nothing that was ugly or evil, but only good. But how can one find such words?" And he continues, "And she was at once silent, and she was unsure, because of some idea she had, some idea that was good and true, but twisted in some small place, that the love of the body, though good and true, was apart from the love of the soul. It had a place where it stayed and had to be called from, and when it was called and done, then it went back to its place and stayed till it was called again, according to some rule and custom." And this is an interesting, as the novel unfolds, it's an interesting exploration of human sexuality within the context of marriage, where from the husband's point of view, I think he has more of this integrated, holistic anthropology, trying to help his wife understand that his desire for her sexually was not just a physical desire, but that sexual desire was indeed for her whole self, for her body, for her soul. That was all significant for him. Whereas in her mind, these were two very distinct things. Her love of him as a person was very distinct from the physical act of intercourse. And because these were very separate for her, you see how this just, in this novel, tragically unfolds. And it's just striking to me that I think, you know, in my experience talking with other Christians and some of their own struggles around this, I think this actually represents where a lot of Christians are at. At this place represented by the wife in this book, because they have kind of this very sharp division between these things. One final result. 3 minutes. Okay. Yeah, this is a fairly big discussion, but I just want to summarize this. So how do we think about the portrayal of sex and nudity in art? Whether you think about art in terms of paintings or in terms of movies, TV shows, things like that. This is where it gets a little bit tricky because I'm not actually a big fan of like the family-friendly rating systems. It's like, this is family-friendly. Like, whatever. Okay, Disney is family-friendly, but they will induce your children into a life of consumerism and misplaced. Anyway, so like, what exactly do you mean by family-friendly? So I was like, family-friendly radio. It's like, yeah, Jesus kind of said you should hate your mother. Is that family-friendly? How does that work? And so I think we need something more complicated. Now, it's good. Obviously, it's good to say, okay, is there sex or is there nudity in this work of art? But we can't be so simplistic as to just say that naked bodies in and of themselves are a problem. That we need to think about how an artistic rendering of human sexuality is put forth. And I think good art, good imagination, is going to illustrate the sacramental nature of bodies and sexuality. That good art is going to say, I can't, you know, this is where I think you can't just say, how is sex portrayed or not, but how is it portrayed? Is it portrayed as a union of two persons? Or you can even say that good art illustrates the brokenness of human life when we try to treat it, or when we mistreat it. So that you see a sense of pain or longing when people don't treat it in the proper way. And I think that's actually more significant. And likewise, bad art, I think, is reductionistic. In other words, it has a lack of imagination that misses the sacramental nature of bodies and sexuality. I think that in art, you know, what concerns me is not just simply a straightforward portrayal of sex or nudity, but a sense of what this says about who we are as human persons, as human beings, and what that means for us. That there's... You can't, this is what I think is interesting, it's really hard to capture the nature of sexual union. That just simply describing it physically doesn't really capture it. I think maybe this is my theory on why almost anything can be taken as innuendo for it, because it's so hard to actually describe and portray. And so I think it takes artistic work, it takes imagination, to try to help us understand this. All right, we'll stop there for today, and I'll see you on Thursday. Don't forget the two things that are due by class time.
Dr. Carlo.
Yeah.
I was at my.